funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we spend so much money on national defense, even at times when we are not directly engaged in international conflict? The founders of the United States were largely suspicious of powerful standing armies, yet today the United States has the most powerful military force in the world. And while that investment may indeed help safeguard national security, my guest would argue it is also motivated by the fact that many areas of the country have grown so economically dependent on defense industry jobs that they will only elect politicians willing to support the industry. Rebecca Euthorpe is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington. Her new book is called The American Warfare State, The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. Rebecca, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How did the framers intend to limit the existence of a permanent military establishment?
Well, the framers designed political institutions in part to prevent unnecessary wars and to limit the power of the president. They were familiar by efforts of British kings to use armies as a means of oppression. And so they gave the power to raise armies, fund them, and declare war to Congress. And they calculated that since legislators were responsive to local voters, who were, of course, expected to fight and die in the nation's wars and pay a substantially higher tax burden, that Congress would only increase defense budgets for specific wars when it was absolutely necessary, and they could check any expansionist inclination that the president might hold.
A lot has changed since then.
Yes.
Until the 20th century, we did, in fact, tend to pull back on defense spending and infrastructure in times when we were not actively engaged in preparing for armed conflict. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Actually, for most of the nation's history, up until World War II, Congress increased military spending in preparation for specific wars and then dismantled the military after the conflict was over, just as the framers expected. And the reason was, in part, because large armies were expensive and they were very difficult to maintain. Permanent military readiness drained public revenue, it disrupted commercial pursuits, and it imposed large burdens on the populace who served in the armed forces and paid a higher tax during wartime.
So what was so different about the years that followed the end of the Second World War?
Well, after World War II, during and after World War II, you see a very pronounced shift. So since that time, policymakers have consistently supported large standing armies and ongoing investments in military technology. And what I argue is that the shift occurred not only as a response to national security concerns, but also because World War II military mobilization extended defense benefits widely, and many rural and semi-rural areas became economically reliant on defense sector jobs and capital, while at the same time, the public costs of war shifted onto a small minority of soldiers who now volunteer to fight, future generations of taxpayers who will inherit the nation's war debts, and foreign populations where U.S. wars take place.
So in terms of spreading around the benefits of military investment, essentially what you're saying is that there are areas that had much more limited economic basis before. Maybe they were agricultural. Suddenly they got a taste of what it was like to have a big munitions plant nearby.
That's exactly right. Military suppliers are currently located in all 50 states and in most counties in the U.S., and defense dollars since World War II have increasingly spread into the South and West. The South, of course, was formerly an agrarian economy. The military-industrial base helped to transform the South into an industrial economy. And it also spread into lightly settled areas outside of central cities. And defense funds are a particularly important source of jobs in these suburbs, towns, and geographically remote regions that lack diverse economies.
Is it possible, Rebecca, that the location of these military defense plants and contractors could have anything to do with the sort of red-blue distribution of voters that we have seen over the past half century?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that because while Congress has consistently supported large defense budgets since World War II, regardless of whether or not the nation is engaged in a war, U.S. military supremacy, support for large defense budgets, and aggressive military interventionism throughout the world was only recently defined as a conservative cause. In fact, in the 1950s, House and Senate Democrats supported military spending more than their Republican counterparts. President Eisenhower battled a Democratic Congress to try and limit defense spending and balance the budget. And in his farewell address, he warned the nation famously of what he called a military-industrial complex. The parties switched positions in the 1980s, they adopted the positions that reflect the relative importance of military spending for their core voters. So as Southern Democrats, what were previously Southern Democrats, became more solidly Republican, defense spending increasingly benefited the core of the newly realigned Republican Party, which were suburbs, towns in the South and West all throughout the Sun Belt. And Democrats became more critical of military spending after their core voters in the Midwest and Northeast lost defense shares, and the South became more uniformly Republican.
So if defense industry jobs are scattered all throughout the country and, you know, subsist in almost every county in the United States, how is it that different regions are more or less dependent on defense dollars?
Well, I argue that it's districts that with less diverse economies that are really inordinately reliant on the defense dollars that they receive. So it's a metric of the relative proportion of defense employment and revenue relative to other industries in a community or in a given region. So just as we see that members of Congress and senators from heavily agricultural regions and areas that are dependent on the automobile industries, particularly in the Midwest, just as these members and senators support widely shared local interests, members representing more defense-dependent districts also have powerful incentives to press for ongoing military spending regardless of the geopolitical climate or national security goals.
And, of course, the military economy is unlike other economic sectors in that the U.S. government is essentially the only buyer in the market, or at least the most important one. Maybe there are some foreign buyers as well. Can you talk about the effect that has on the way that market works?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. So it creates a mutual dependency. So on one hand, the government needs to make sure that defense industries continue to remain profitable and that they stay in business, so that they can prepare, maintain military readiness and prepare for wars. And at the same time, that industry is dependent on the government as the sole buyer, or at least the sole legal buyer of most of their products in order to stay in business. So that does create symbiotic relations between the industries themselves and the government purchaser.
You point out that previous studies of the defense economy have placed a greater emphasis on, say, government-run facilities like military bases than on private defense contractors. Why have they done that, and why do you see that as such a glaring oversight?
Well, the reason that that most other studies focus solely on military bases or primarily on military bases and airfields is because that information is publicly available. Information on the locations of private defense industries, there's no central database indicating where those defense industries are located. So in order to improve upon previous metrics and circumvent that problem, I built a unique data set consisting of the nationwide locations of major defense industries throughout the nation. And to do that, I had to look at companies' tax reports, their 10K tax filings located at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and all sorts of other documents. So it was a very time-consuming and laborious process.
Did you have to file Freedom of Information Act requests, or how were you able to get your hands on the data that you did use?
I did not use Freedom of Information Act requests for the defense industry data. I mostly relied on you use things like Google mapping techniques. I used geographic information system software. I used public interest reports, data that had been collected by non-for-profits in the past. I compiled data from various sources, but the most important source for me was companies' tax files that they had submitted to the SEC. And this is because in these files, companies are required to list their major holdings. And those also I can I could get historical, or at least some historical data from that as well, rather than simply relying on the most, you know, the layout of the defense sector, you know, today in 2014.
So what was it that became apparent to you when you incorporated the economic impact of those private defense companies on regional economies, in addition to the straight out, you know, Department of Defense spending on Department of Defense facilities and personnel?
Well, it really, I think, amplifies the previous measure. And in fact, a lot of the private defense industries are strategically located close to military bases and airfields, you know, for, you know, access and proximity. That, of course, is beneficial. What I think that looking at the private defense industries does is give a more complete picture of really the size and scope and scale of the military industry in the United States.
And of course, there are also subcontractors to consider. How did you how did you bring those into your study?
Well, my metric for on defense industry data does not include subcontractors. Hopefully, future researchers will have the ingenuity and the resources to track those down as well. But that was just too difficult for me to get a handle on. Although I did look at the subcontracting, where not only where the Department of Defense awards contracts to the major companies, but also where these companies then just distribute funding for parts and supplies, and it basically that gives a more complete picture of the flow of defense dollars.
Lots of people in this country are uncomfortable with the idea of government jobs programs, right? Creating jobs, working for the government in some capacity just so that people will have jobs and they'll get things done. Did you sense that some of this military contracting is kind of an end run around the same thing?
How do you mean?
In other words, do these defense contracts function as a way to sort of take government money and create jobs for citizens who otherwise might be unemployed in areas that don't have economic diversity?
Oh, well, it's absolutely a government jobs program. It's of course perceived very differently than other types of government spending. I don't think that it's, at least I don't, the evidence that I've seen does not necessarily suggest that areas with a great level of economic need with high employment will necessarily locate a defense industry in that area, or that defense the CEOs of these weapons industries will strategically locate a weapons facility in those areas. But what you do see is that since World War II, a lot of areas that already had very homogenous economies, you know, previously had agricultural economies, developed these military economies and developed this sort of dependence on continued defense dollars.
My guest is Rebecca U. Thorpe. She's assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The American Warfare State, The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Rebecca U. Thorpe. She is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The American Warfare State, The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Rebecca, let's talk about how this level of commitment to defense spending affects the way we think in this country, and particularly our elected officials think in this country, about overseas military aggression. For one thing, we are sort of ready at all times to engage should something happen. Is that right?
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And so the president, although the president has to go to Congress to finance a war, the money's already been spent and the equipment's already there. Talk about the repercussions of that in terms of actual policy.
Well, since defense spending has become such a crucial component of the nation's, of the national, of state, of regional, local, and even the national economy, that can be maintained without directly imposing costs on most U.S. voters. This, in effect, frees presidents to monopolize the military resources that Congress has already appropriated and to launch military actions without democratic deliberation or congressional authorization, which is, of course, an outcome that the constitutional framers feared and that they explicitly tried to prevent.
So I think a lot of people might be able to call these to mind, but give us some examples in recent history of things that presidents have done that have looked very much like declarations of war, but which, because they didn't need to requisition the extra money, they were able to go ahead and act unilaterally before consulting Congress.
Well, there actually hasn't been a single declaration of war since World War II. The Korean War in 1950 was the first was famously the first real undeclared war, which President Truman referred to as a police action, as sort of a semantic maneuver to try and justify or legitimize the absence of a congressional declaration of war. In more recent periods, the Iraq War received congressional authorization, but instead of declaring a war, Congress essentially gave President Bush and the administration a carte blanche authority to go to war in the Iraq region if and when he so chose. So, of course, the authorization to use military force in Iraq was passed in 2002. President Bush didn't actually send forces to the region until March of 2003. In more recent times, even under the Obama administration, who really campaigned against President Bush's national security policies and what he saw was an abuse of executive war power. So President Obama has withdrawn troops and tried to scale back the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but has actually amplified the use of drones. So the airstrikes in Libya was not congressionally authorized, no declaration of war. The ongoing use of drone strikes in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Yemen, in regions where Congress has never authorized the use of military force.
And is the issue that congressional representatives, maybe many of them have interests within their districts that are producing these munitions and this materiel that is useful in these conflicts, and therefore they are disinclined to object when presidents order these actions?
That's right. At least that's a big part of the story. So we have these new geopolitical, economic, and political circumstances that encourage a critical subset of legislators to, you know, join relevant defense committees and push to expand the defense arsenal, regardless of whether or not the nation is engaged in a war. While at the same time, policies have also reduced the public costs and the public burdens associated with military spending in war. So there is less of an incentive for a member of Congress, even if they don't come from a defense-dependent district, to necessarily object to these actions.
When you say that the public costs have fallen, certainly taxpayers are still financing this sort of thing, but we're also borrowing a lot of money. Is that right?
That's exactly right, yes. So since the 1980s, we've seen a much greater reliance on deficit spending, both to fund the defense buildup under Reagan and then in every subsequent decade. So this reliance on deficit spending has circumvented a traditional need to rely on a current tax base to maintain existing weapons platforms or to commit troops abroad. So the Iraq War was famously the first war in U.S. history that didn't require Congress to raise taxes. Much of it came out of federal borrowing.
We are certainly not the only industrialized democracy that has a larger permanent military presence today than we had a century ago. Is that correct?
Yes, of course, that's correct.
So, I mean, to what extent is this simply a response to the conditions of the world we live in the 21st century?
Well, it is certainly a response to heightened national security threats. First, you had the rise of the Soviet Empire, which compelled continued military readiness after World War II had ended. The attacks of September 11th, 2001, the threat of international terrorism, and of course, all these things contribute to this environment, which is fueling, the continued levels of military spending. But even with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan winding down, even in the current period where we see these severe budget deficits and declining resources, the U.S. Continues to allocate. Congress specifically continues to allocate nearly as much for the military as every other country in the world combined. So the U.S. is certainly, I would suggest, an exceptional case in terms of the priority of military goals and the level of military spending.
Is there an objective way to evaluate that spending? I mean, there must be some people in this country who have looked at this issue that say, well, this is the right size for a military budget. This is the size the military should be. Obviously, there are many, many people who disagree with that and who think it's too high. There may be people who think it's too low. I mean, is there an objective way to evaluate the appropriateness of our appropriations?
That's a very difficult question and probably beyond my pay grade. But one way to look at what's necessary for military and for military readiness and national security is to look at what the administration and the Secretary of Defense thinks is necessary, as opposed to what Congress's priorities are. Since Clinton fought Congress. George H.W. Bush and then Clinton fought Congress to reduce defense budgets after the Cold War was receding and then became a distant memory, and Congress continued to support the weapons platforms that were designed to fight the Soviet Union, who no longer existed and was no longer a threat. George W. Bush tried to cancel a number of very expensive stealth aircraft, including the F-22 stealth fighter and the Seawolf submarine. Barack Obama fought that same battle and was actually able to successfully convince Congress to cancel the F-22, although that's been replaced with the F-35, which Congress continues to insert billions of dollars for, despite serious performance problems. And, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel recently tried to eliminate funding for an attack aircraft, a U-2 spy plane, and a Navy cruiser, and the House Armed Services Committee voted to keep all three.
Is it your sense that congressional representatives, senators, can simply not stay in office if they vote against military spending, particularly that which would affect their own districts?
Well, members of Congress, of course, are very conservative. In the sense that, not in a left-right dimension, mm-hmm. but in the sense that most members of Congress, they don't want to necessarily take the risk. So if defense spending and military industries are really integral to the economy, then these districts are also likely to elect members of Congress that will support these widely shared interests. And it's not simply a crude metric that, you know, these members of Congress, you know, want to support these programs in order to you know, help their local economies. But these are also members that have likely, you know, internalized, you know, values that, you know, support for military supremacy. You know, they see these things as, you know, really in the national security interest and really for the public good.
So are you saying that this reliance on the military economy, on the defense economy, affects the way elected officials and Americans in general interpret threats from outside this country?
Not necessarily the way that we interpret threats, but certainly I think it affects the way that we think about the best way to respond to these threats. So in that sense, we see intersecting and converging interests and ideology, both of which support continued military spending, military interventionism, and an aggressive military posture.
So I can't remember the figure in my head. I believe it's in the book. But if you compare, say, State Department expenditures with Defense Department expenditures, these are two different ways to manage international conflict, essentially. And of course, the Defense Department budget is larger by a magnitude of multiples. Is this because there are not State Department jobs in every county in the United States?
I think that's it's not quite that simple, mm-hmm. but that's a big, I do think that that's part of it. It's the interest in maintaining a military economy. And part of those interests are jobs. Part of that interest is, you know, is the, you know, the national, you know, geopolitical and political power and authority and prestige that comes with having and maintaining the most powerful military in the world. So what we've seen since World War II is an increasing number of benefits, at least short-term benefits, that are associated with high levels of military spending, while at the same time we've seen systematic reductions in the direct costs imposed on U.S. voters associated with maintaining that level of spending.
Okay, so we talked about direct costs in the form of, you know, borrowed money and sort of deferred debt as opposed to paying right now with higher tax rates. There's also this issue of, you know, we have an all-volunteer military. Can you talk about how that has affected our willingness to support an industry that might potentially put a lot of people in harm's way?
Yeah, so in 1973, after the Vietnam War, President Nixon eliminated the draft and instituted what's called an all-volunteer force, which, you know, as it sounds, means that people that serve in the military do so on a voluntary basis. So military service was transformed from an obligation tied to citizenship to a voluntary act. And, you know, this certainly influences Americans' cost-benefit calculations when we think about foreign entanglements and, you know, the U.S. role in the world. You know, in response to the Vietnam War, you saw, you know, massive protests, people burning their draft cards, and that war became very publicly contentious. Whereas the Iraq War, even when it became unpopular, and even when, you know, it was affecting Republicans' electoral prospects, it was affecting George W. Bush's public approval ratings, the level of contention never quite reached the same level that it was. You know, we didn't see the same sort of public backlash that we saw during the Vietnam War. And I think a large part of that is, you know, that less than 1 in every 1,000 Americans fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a lower proportion than we've seen in comparable wars throughout U.S. history.
And even with all the risk of injury or death to our men and women in uniform, which does concern, I think, just about every American, we have this sort of secondary shadow force of military contractors who somehow are not thought of in quite the same way as people who have enlisted in the military voluntarily.
That's right. So since the 1990s, private military and security contractors are increasingly employed in U.S. war zones. There was a point, I think it was around 2006 or 2007, where there are just as many private military contractors serving in or stationed in Iraq and in Afghanistan as there were actual U.S. troops and U.S. volunteers. So, of course, this reduces the need to rely on a large volunteer contingent. It reduces pressure for the Pentagon in recruiting volunteers in sending U.S. military personnel overseas, when you can just rely on on the private sector in order to perform those duties and those missions.
And I don't know the answer to this, but I assume that are we paying more per capita for the labor of those private contractors than we are for a soldier?
The jury's out, I think, on that question. I mean, there are some studies that suggest that the privatization, part of the move toward privatization, was for cost efficiency. There are some studies that say that that it lowers costs. The bulk of the research suggests that it's actually much more expensive to rely on private military security contractors than it is to rely on U.S. soldiers. And, of course, in doing so, in drawing on the private sector, this is just another way for the president to circumvent Congress's former control over the military. So, Congress can control, the number of U.S. military personnel. Congress has the power to raise armies and regulate their usage. Congress knows how many U.S. military personnel are deployed in different parts of the world. It's much more difficult for Congress to keep tabs on the private sector.
We're speaking this hour with Rebecca U. Thorpe. She's assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The American Warfare State: The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. If you'd like to ask a question or weigh in on this conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with University of Washington Assistant Professor of Political Science Rebecca U. Thorpe, author of the new book, The American Warfare State: The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Eddie, calling from Houston. Hi, Eddie.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'd like the author to discuss the obvious conflict of interest with the privatization of the military, companies like Blackwater, for example. The folks that run that company have been directly related to government positions. And just wanted to see what she thought about that.
Thanks for your call.
I appreciate the question. I think that the privatization of providing security overseas is just a part of an ongoing trend toward privatizing former responsibilities and obligations that were associated with the U.S. Active DoD soldiers were expected to perform. So doing laundry and peeling potatoes and food services. So increasingly, the Department of Defense has relied on private contractors to perform those sorts of logistical support. And now increasingly we see reliance on companies like Blackwater. Blackwater is actually, I think, they're no longer called that. They've had to change their name 2 times. They're associated with negative publicity related to related to misconduct overseas. Now I believe they're called, they're relabeled as Z. And so relying on the private sector for those sorts of functions overseas, including, you know, now security, fighting alongside U.S. soldiers, just is another way of sort of amplifying and amplifying the same trends that we've already seen, trends that reduce the direct costs for the U.S. public and shift the costs onto non-voting populations and populations outside of the U.S. sphere.
How does the economic reliance of particularly rural parts of the country or formerly rural parts of the country on the defense industry affect the way different members of Congress vie to join defense-related committees within Congress?
Well, the most economically reliant members of Congress, you know, will be more likely, they're more likely than their counterparts in Congress to join defense committees, to support specific weapons programs, and to really champion champion defense interests in Congress. And they aggressively try to shape the way that questions about the military are being debated in Congress.
To be fair, is that any different from somebody from an oil-producing state wanting to be on an energy committee or someone from, you know, a state that produces timber wanting to be? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, isn't that just...
It's exactly the same, with the exception that the U.S. military industry is wider. It's more expansive in scale and in scope. Most of these oil-producing regions are, you know, are very heavily concentrated. And with the U.S. military industry, again, as I mentioned, you know, they're in every single state and almost every county in the United States. So it's much more pervasive in that sense.
It's
not limited to a specific region, although defense interests, there are regions that are more heavily dependent than other regions, but it's also more widespread.
It would seem, I was about to say that if this is so diverse geographically, and I recognize that some areas are more dependent than others on income from the defense industry, but it would seem like across the board cuts would be easier to make, right, if they don't affect any one area disproportionately.
Well, you would think that, but what ends up happening is a lot of these members, you know, they'll be just as aggressive in trying to stave off generalized defense cuts is they will be to support the weapons platforms that are located in their districts. And again, it becomes more complicated when you take into account, you know, the ideological incentives of these members as well. It's not simply that these members, you know, want to support the economic interests in their districts. I mean, part of it is that, and part of it is also that, you know, these are, you know, very adamant defense hawks that have, you know, internalized U.S. military supremacy as a core, national security necessity.
So you're saying it's hard to draw a line between their motivations.
That's exactly right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have George on the line now in Dallas. Hi, George.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For your speaker, I had a professor years ago who used to quip that if we had spent all of our money that we spend on defense on private research, R&D, you know, helping our car companies, that Toyota would have never sold a car in U.S. Any opinion on that? Are we misdirecting our resources?
Rebecca?
Well, the financial expense of defense buildup certainly has opportunity costs in the United States. So all this spending, you know, since World War II, there's been hundreds of billions of dollars that are spent for the military every single year. And, of course, during times of war, that, you know, typically increases even more. The last figure I heard is that, you know, all told, the U.S. has spent $3 trillion fighting the Iraq war. So, you know, these are funds that could be spent on things like infrastructure, on healthcare, on education, on other types of jobs programs. And of course, the borrowing used to finance military procurements will also constrain U.S. taxpayers who will inherit a larger national debt and who might have chosen to spend the money in other ways.
Help me understand this, Rebecca. Members of Congress, at least members of Congress who are from the party that is different from whatever president is in power, are typically not eager to provide that president with any more ability to get things done than he would like to have, than he absolutely has to have. So why has there not been more vocal opposition to the ability of presidents to move aggressively in terms of aggressive international policy with regard to military spending? Is it simply because there is so much support back home for keeping the defense industry locally afloat?
That's, I think, part of it. We've seen, of course, recently, very intense levels of gridlock in Congress and just a refusal of both parties to cooperate with the other. And, you know, we've seen Republican members of Congress, you know, do everything they can to try and disrupt or sabotage or oppose the president's agenda. When the president ordered U.S. airstrikes in Libya, for example, you know, Republican members of Congress, you know, they made a lot of noise about that. They claimed that, you know, that he was acting in unconstitutionally. Congress hadn't authorized the war. They claimed that he was violating the War Powers Act, which was something that was passed in 1973 to try and give Congress more authority over the military. But they continued to provide the resources that allowed the president to carry out that particular mission. In the Iraq War, Republicans uniformly supported, George W. Bush, also a Republican president. I mean, you see that the Democratic Party actually split on that measure. And the Democrats who supported the authorization for the use of force and who continue to support supplemental budgets to continue to fund the war, even after 2006, when Democrats had the majority and the war was unpopular, these tended to be members of Congress, from districts that were disproportionately reliant on the defense sector, on maintaining a war economy.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Paul on the line in North Dallas. Hey, Paul.
Hi. You know, when I was growing up, one way to increase the amount of jobs in the United States was to have a hot little war. But now that we've outsourced so much of our military manufacturing to the rest of the world, I understand that that is no longer true. I'd like to know what kind of impact has that made on the military-industrial complex.
How much of it is outsourced, Rebecca?
It's interesting that you brought that up, Paul, because in most cases, that's exactly right, that, you know, U.S. manufacturing base has declined, and increasingly, you know, those jobs are outsourced to other countries. But the U.S. military is actually the one real exception to that trend. For national security reasons, most of the U.S. weapons platforms are actually still built in the United States. So that allows, you know, U.S. to maintain, a military industrial base. And certainly, you know, the research and development support for, you know, military technologies, you know, for scientific advancement that are associated with DOD funding, all those sorts of things. Most of those funds actually do typically stay in the United States.
If we decided as a society that we were unhappy with the way things have gone, would there be a strategy for sort of unlatching from this process that we've had of expanding military spending and spreading it out to every region of the country, particularly those that have no other economic base to rely on?
Well, I think it would require... It would certainly require a broad level of national reflection. It would require that people understand exactly what's going on. And it would require for people to understand that, you know, while a lot of people in the United States are benefiting in the short run from, you know, from levels of spending and even from, you know, U.S. military and foreign policy engagements, that this also has this has long-term costs. It has long-term consequences. It has, you know, certainly opportunity costs in the U.S. that that I had mentioned. It will, you know, constrain, you know, future generations. It, you know, it's increasing deficits. It's adding to the debt, and it's also, you know, while fewer Americans fight and die in the nation's wars than any previous historical period, that a small segment of volunteers are shouldering this burden. And these volunteers are being sent, you know, for repeated tours of duty. You know, they're coming home with, you know, increasing levels of post-traumatic stress disorder and all sorts of other problems, which is also, I mean, that, and that's creating more problems with, you know, with you know, veterans benefits and how do we take care of our wounded warriors. And the foreign populations where the U.S. fights its wars, who incur ongoing damage to economic infrastructure, the loss of civilian lives, it would, I think, require, you know, it would require the U.S. public to understand, you know, what's going on and all of, you know, the devastating costs that are imposed elsewhere, and to, you know, and to make a decision that, whether or not that it's really worth those trade-offs.
Is it possible that we are, with all of this spending that looks, that is at historically unprecedented rates, are we maybe speaking softly and carrying a big stick? Are we spending all this money on defense and on weapons in particular, so that we don't have to engage in as much active conflict?
Well, I think certainly yes, deterrence is a very strong motivator, mm-hmm. And it's related to, you know, to the, you know, the ability to build up and develop overwhelming force. That was certainly true when the U.S. Was fighting the Soviet Union. It was certainly part of the both strategic and psychological motivation that propelled a lot of the arms racing. Today, though, that, you know, I think that that sort of motivation is less convincing, considering that the type of threats that the U.S. is currently faced with are largely asymmetrical. So maintaining, you know, stealth aircraft, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, bombers, the type of weapon systems that were designed initially to fight the Cold War, those are not the type of weapons that are particularly useful in combating international terrorism.
Rebecca, I've got to jump in. We are out of time. Rebecca U. Thorpe is assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and author of The American Welfare State, The Domestic Politics of Military Spending. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.